They mean these names should change the sign. The New York Mutters, Detroit Murders, and Chicago Mob. Boston Biggest, Texas Swindlers, and the LA Cops. Miami Drugs, New Jersey Dumps, take on the Denver Frogs. Seattle Bats, New Orleans Hoods, Milwaukee Cannibals. San Diego Sharkheads, and the Arizona Dogs.
Let's Talk Mania! Let's Talk Mania!
Washington Pride, home team band play cock killer when LA comes to town. Pittsburgh polluters, Houston drive-by dumpster near the fair. From the Florida the abortion bombers into San Francisco queers.
Let's Talk Mania, Let's Talk Mania, Let's Talk Mania, Let's Talk Mania,
Anywhere you go, the game's the same old thing. Bet your money on the bribes. They always win.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Not Another Sports Show, your progressive look at the world of sports. We're broadcasting live here on 10.5 Urbana, Illinois, WRFU LP Urbana.
Just before we get started, a little disclaimer. WRFU is an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, the UCIMC, or the Urbana Socialist Forum.
Welcome again to Not Another Sports Show here on WRFU. This week's news of the week, there's quite a lot to run down, Damian, and we've got a very full schedule ahead of us.
Oh, indeed we do. Where to start?
How about with the Togo soccer team?
Indeed. Yeah, this is actually pretty tragic. It looks like there was a shooting of the Togo's soccer team as they were going towards their practice field.
They were traveling to their facility for the African Cup.
Right. And just ambushed on the Angolan border in a bus, and it looks like possibly four people killed, including a second string goalkeeper. Possibly. I guess there's conflicting reports about that. But the driver was killed. Two other, I think, supporting staff for the team were killed. Just tragic. It looks like they're going to be pulling out from the cup, right?
And I think other teams might be pulling out as well and just
in protest of this,
of what
right?
Happened.
No, it's a mess, and it's really unclear. I'm just not clear why they were targeted.
It appears to be Angolan separatists that were targeting them.
Yeah, but
and
I mean,
even
such a strange. Like, why go after them? You know, it just doesn't does not compute.
Well, the government of Angola even said, you know, they should have flown and not drove.
Right, other like international soccer officials have also said the same thing. They were a little surprised that they drove the whole way there, but still. I mean, Togo itself, I guess, is not the paragon of political stability either. But it wasn't even within their own borders that this happened. It was on the Angolan border. So,
wow, we got NFL playoffs. Magic. Pete Carroll allegedly signing with the Seattle Seahawks, and here we are leading off with Togo football.
Well,
Togo soccer.
Yeah, well, in every other country in the world, it's called football, but yeah.
From one story of considering what the hell was going on to another. Buddhism is apparently inferior to Christianity when it comes to the forgiveness of sins, according to Fox News pundit Britt Hume.
Because, you know, he's the person that I generally go to with questions of ethics and religion and things like that. That's like the top name that comes to mind when I think about things like that. But yeah,
WWBHD.
what would Britt Hume do? Yeah, I guess so.
Tiger Woods should turn his back on Buddhism and become a Christian to be forgiven for cheating on his wife, Hume told Fox News's Chris Wallace Sunday. Quote, "The extent to which he can recover seems to me to be dependent on his faith," said Hume. Quote, "He is said to be a Buddhist. I don't think that faith offers the kind of redemption and forgiveness offered by the Christian faith. My message to Tiger is, Tiger, turn to the Christian faith, and you can make a total recovery and be a great example to the world," close quote. He subsequently also went on the Bill O'Reilly show, and yes, Damien, they did do it live. And he furthered to stick his foot in his mouth by saying that he was not proselytizing, and then began to proselytize again by saying that Buddhism was not as good of a religion for accepting of sins as Christianity was.
I mean, I'm no expert on religion or anything, but I thought Buddhism was about purity of the soul and doing things which got you more in tune with your Buddha nature or something like that. I don't know. I don't know where this guy's coming from. It seems like a really strange thing to just interject into the whole Tiger Woods story. You know, he should be a Christian. I don't know where that came from, Britt, but good on you, I guess, for bad mouthing of world religions. Anyway,
he was so much better when he was an apologist just for the Bush administration before he kept talking about sports.
Yeah, stick with what you're good at, Britt. Oh, well. So what else do we got, Neil?
NFL officials are doing basic scientific research that is going to give players and equipment managers more information about helmets and will help manufacturers know where they could improve equipment. As we've talked about on this show previously about healthcare and concussion issues, the problem with concussions in Major League Football National Football League, excuse me, is a very serious issue.
Mm-hmm.
NFL spokesperson Greg Aiello wrote in an email to the Associated Press, quote, "The majority of players are still wearing helmets designed in the 90s. That's a key reason we wanted to initiate more research on helmets," end quote. Another possible result of the testing is that the league could use the data to see if there are potential rules changes that should be made, said Jeff Posch, NFL Executive Vice President and Chief Counsel. Quote, "This study can be used by our competition committee and others to find, for example, that there are certain impacts that are particularly difficult to attenuate the forces. Maybe you can go into consideration of how you set up the rules of the game and how you enforce those rules," close quote.
Mm-hmm.
The first round of NFL's helmet testing, done from October to December at Halstead's lab and a lab in Canada, looked at how two helmet models made 10 years ago and present-day models responded to blows at various angles and speeds, up to about 22 miles per hour. Specific helmet-to-helmet data won't be released before March, though.
Well, that's important research, though. I mean, it seems like every week we have something to talk about, concussion-related news in football. So, yeah, I mean, it's about time they start doing something about this, you know. Definitely look into it.
It's very much so after seeing more players go down with concussions this season, too.
And, of course, we have what's-his-name, that doctor that denies that... I love this. He says there's not enough evidence to link head injuries to brain damage. it doesn't take a PhD in biology. I'm pretty sure the brain is located mostly in the... in the head area, right, Neil? I mean, you'd think an injury to the head would kind of have something to do with that, but what was that guy's name? I think I have Ira Kaysen, is that it?
Yes.
Yeah. What a mess, right? So under questioning from Congress, this guy, Dr. Ira Kaysen, who used to lead the NFL's concussion committee, stuck to his position that there is no proven connection between football head injuries and brain disease. Members of the House Judiciary Committee expressed frustration at the oral and written testimony delivered at Monday's hearing by Dr. Kaysen, a neurologist from New York and a former co-chairman of the NFL's panel on head injuries. "There's not enough valid, reliable, and objective scientific evidence at present to determine whether or not repeated head injuries in professional football result in long-term brain damage," Kaysen said. There's a reason you resigned, goofball.
Yes, you were forced to resign, and you were publicly shamed in front of Congress for not believing this. In every study that was done, he would constantly try to find holes in it, saying that, to poo-poo all this kind of research that was being done.
Right, I mean...
Rather than defending his own point.
Exactly. There's something to be said for, scientific integrity, and you want to be... something of a devil's advocate whenever there's any research going on. But this guy seems like he's just on a crusade, just bizarre.
I just wonder if there's going to be like any Climate Gate style emails about brain injuries. It's all fake. They were all faking it.
That would be hilarious. No, it seems like one of those sorts of things, right? It's like you just have a clan of deniers about this, and it's just a strange thing to argue against.
We don't need your cold, hard, incontrovertible fact.
Well, you know, facts do have a liberal bias.
Oh, but, yes. last week on the show, we had talked about the bowl championship series and their outright sham of a bowl game between Texas and Alabama, which, as a form of protest, we're not going to talk about. Playoff PAC, a political action committee supporting a college football playoff for the national championship, ran 30-second advertisement spots during the Boise State TCU, as one of the greatest names I ever heard for it, the Separate But Equal Bowl.
Yeah, I know.
For the Fiesta Bowl. And they also ran ads in Dallas-Fort Worth, Boise, and in Salt Lake City, where last year the Utah Utes went undefeated, but they were also shut out of the national championship game by the BCS, because they all came from non-BCS districts.
Nah, it's just miserable. Let's see, what other news do we have? The University of Texas Faculty Council condemned Mac Brown's raise from $3 million to $5 million a year. They deemed it as unseemly and inappropriate. Brown is the Texas coach who has led the team to the national championship game played Friday night.
Which we won't tell you who won.
Yeah, that's right. The other bowl game, right? At a time when the Texas football is doing remarkably well, the rest of the campus is tightening its belt. The UT Tuition Policy Advisory Committee has recommended that undergraduate tuition increase 4% a year for the next 2 years. Departments across the campus are feeling the pinch and being asked to make significant budget cuts. $5 million in liberal arts next year alone. Layoffs and hiring freezes have been announced in several departments. This is similar to issues at the University of California, where fee increases were something around, like, was it 30% or something like that for students? And the Golden Bears are getting millions in loans forgiven because they just can't come up with the revenue in order to stay neutral or even positive. It's, you know, you want to reward people who do a good job, and you know, Mac Brown is, well, I mean, he's doing a fair bit better than certain other coaches like Zook. You know, there's a time and a place for these sorts of raises, right? And you know, you have to sort of keep in mind the central mission of a university. And if you're going to be betraying students, you know, in order to come up with another $2 million a year for one person, it's just not right, you know?
Well, you know, I've seen a lot of people on, like, Texas message boards and other message boards trying to apologize for this kind of thing, saying that it's perfectly okay. And it's perfectly right for Mac Brown to get a $2 million raise, saying that he should be rewarded for what he's done.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said about that, right?
But is the university primarily there for education of students, or is it primarily there for a football franchise that just happens to have classes?
Exactly. You know, and especially, you know, a state-run university like that, where, you know, the real obligation is service to the residents of Texas, you know, and an educational service to the people in Texas, and that has to be priority number one. You know, I'm sorry, but especially in these tight financial times.
And we will be going into detail about an incident at another Texas school. The Texas Tech Red Raiders had a controversy
recently
with their head coach getting removed prior to their bowl game, but we'll get to that in a few minutes.
Interesting story, though. But yeah, stay tuned.
Gilbert Arenas, as most of you have probably heard, it's made national news headlines, and it's been outright just every single day hearing something new about the Gilbert Arenas story. Gilbert Arenas had a gun at the Washington Verizon Center, which at best violated the NBA's collective bargaining agreement, which bans weapons from being brought to work. And at worst, it violated DC's gun laws. The story is pretty much this. Gilbert Arenas, Javaris Crittenden, JaVale McGee were all playing cards on a flight home from Phoenix before Christmas. Arenas and Crittenden had both lost big, but because he was upset over a dispute about the rules, Arenas had quit the game, leaving Crittenden to pay the entire pot himself. Crittenden argued with Arenas over his share of the losing, and at one point jokingly threatened to shoot Arenas in his left knee, which he just had surgery on and has been coming back from injuries for him. 2 days later, there was a very big incident that took place when Arenas showed up and thought it would be funny to place three of his own guns in Crittenden's locker with a note saying, "Pick one." Crittenden apparently didn't think it was funny. He angrily picked up one of the guns and allegedly threw it across the locker room, screaming about how he has his own gun and doesn't need hand-me-downs. Some stories from the locker room are then saying that Crittenden then chambered around into his own gun and started singing.
Man, oh man. Wow.
The NBA commissioner had chosen not to punish Arenas until an investigation was done by the Washington, D.C. Police Department. However, during a recent game, Arenas, during the introductions, had mimicked the touchdown celebration from the film Any Given Sunday, where he acted like his fingers were guns and his teammates fell around him from the imaginary bullets. And Stern was very quickly able to suspend him indefinitely from the league.
Yeah.
Al Sharpton even went into this, telling David Stern, the NBA commissioner, to show no mercy on Arenas. Sharpton said, quote, "If it had been a white player pointing a gun at a black player, there would have been much more of an uproar. It's almost as if people are saying, well, we don't expect anything better from our black athletes," end quote. I'm sorry, Al, I've heard this story so many times on the media, it can't get to much more of an uproar than it's already getting. Everybody is coming out, and I'll even condemn him, you don't bring guns to work.
Yeah.
Guns do not make jokes. Like, you don't put guns in somebody else's locker and then joke around about them shooting you with those guns. At best, he violated, he did something incredibly stupid, and he violated the collective bargaining agreement. That's more than enough to suspend him indefinitely.
Absolutely.
If he violated anything criminally, he's looking at losing the last 80-some-odd million dollars of his $111 million contract. There have been high-profile robberies, assaults, and home invasions of NBA players, though, over the last decade. You had Sean Taylor a couple of seasons ago, NFL player for the Redskins, who was shot while trying to defend his family from a armed robbery that was taking place in his home. And a lot of players are scared for their families and don't want to hire bodyguards, and they've taken up their right to bear arms and have private weapons in their homes. And Arenas' argument for having the guns in the stadium was that he wanted them away from his children.
Well, lock them up. You know, I mean, other people have ways of solving this problem. You know, there's people with families that have guns, and they lock them up. You know, that's a little weak. I think that's sort of an after the fact excuse. You know, no.
As Dave Zirin said, quote, "Arenas is not the poster child of a culture of violence. He's a frustrated athlete playing through his worst season who did something incredibly dumb. Al Sharpton turning him into Iceberg Slim doesn't make it any easier. If Sharpton's really concerned about violence, go protest the two wars being ramped up by Obama and the NBA's partnerships with the Pentagon." No. Which is a very cogent point. That, you know, there's all this talk about the culture of violence, and I think this is mainly black athletes owning guns, which is scary to people for some reason, that black athletes would own handguns. This isn't about some, you know, visions of, instead of like visions of sugar plums dancing in their heads, they got visions of thugs dancing in their heads of black people with gun equal gang member, black people with gun equal criminal.
No.
And that's
absolutely right.
A real dangerous prejudice to have, and you can kind of see that coming out quite significantly in this Gilbert Arenas case.
Definitely. Definitely. Oh, well. Let's see. What else do we got? Los Angeles is looking at an $800 million football stadium project. Who's going to be playing there? Your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, I don't know.
Current reports look like there's some possibilities of who might be moving in. Let's see, the Jacksonville Jaguars, there's some buzz about them. Buffalo Bills, I guess there's also, they might have a shot. There's some rumors about some other teams like the San Diego Chargers, the Oakland Raiders, San Francisco 49ers, the Vikings, St. Louis Rams. In 2009, the residents of Los Angeles voted just overwhelming, 60-1, to approve a $500 million bond package, with some of the funds going towards public improvements to support the stadium. But the stadium, we are told, will be built with private funds by billionaire real estate mogul Ed Roskey Jr. and he will want in return a 40% stake in whatever team makes it in that way ends up occupying the stadium.
Who would even like want to pay money? It's like, we're gonna build a stadium, but we've got no team to put in it.
No, I know. It's like you know, that line from the movie, "If you build it, they will come." That was a movie, folks. That's not real life. No, I mean, yeah. If you think of this as like a personal investment, right? No family would just put money out there. You know, I mean, this is like a snake oil kind of gimmick or something. You know, you want to have some kind of confidence, especially this kind of money, that you'll have some like real tangible interest in this, and especially in this economic climate, right? You'd think anyway, but yeah. Anyway, it's a big mess.
There's a lot of protests to this,
oh,
right?
Yeah, oh, definitely. I mean, even environmentalists are protesting it because the state environmental laws are being waived for the construction of the stadium. Studies from think tanks such as the Brookings Institution and the Cato Institute have shown that stadium funding never brings an effective return on its investment.
Those noted socialists over at the Cato Institute.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I mean,
the right-wing libertarians.
It's very rare that Neil or I would actually reference anything produced by the Cato Institute, but sometimes, yeah, okay. Anyway, let's see, Governor Schwarzenegger and Roski have also promised, who is this, Maria Elena DeRazzo,
mm-hmm.
Executive Secretary of the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor, that concession workers and parking attendants will be paid what he calls middle-class wages. Okay. This is true economic development, DeRazzo says. It's going to benefit everyone in the community, another quote. The typical pay for these jobs is $7.65 an hour, which would be middle class if JFK were president, right? I mean, $7.65. I mean,
don't spend it all in one place.
No kidding, yeah. It's like, oh, geez, the generosity of it. You know, I mean, that's something else. You know, like you always hear about, you know, the unemployment rate holding flat or how many new jobs are being created. You have to think about what kind of jobs they are. You know, are people getting the hours they want? And is it going to be a $7.65 an hour job, or is it going to be something that, you know, pays something halfway decent? Anyway, yeah.
In a little bit more lighthearted story,
no, I like this story.
Former Bulls star Scottie Pippen was allegedly assaulted by little people while filming a scene for a film called Midgets vs. Mascots.
And you can watch it on YouTube. It's a horrifying scene. Oh man, he gets bashed over the head by Gary Coleman with a telephone. Okay, the news report said he got hit twice. I only saw it happen once, but Pippen goes down after the first hit, and then he's just swarmed by all these little people. And they're screaming, and you just see like little fists flying, and it's insane. But anyway, there's a film on YouTube about it. I personally think it's fascinating stuff because I'm a connoisseur of lowbrow humor. but supposedly Pippen actually also injured one of the little people enough to actually warrant a trip to the hospital. But then in a press statement later, Pippen indicated that he would not be pursuing any action, which I assume means legal action. And he, to his knowledge, was not, there was no legal action against him. It was sort of a punked sort of scene. They were supposed to be staging a fight or an argument that turned into a fight. But anyway, very funny. Check it out on YouTube if you get a chance.
And now, like we had said, we were going to keep talking about college football related to the Texas Tech Red Raiders. But before we get to that, briefly, we are going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back with further headlines about the Texas Tech Red Raiders.
Stay tuned.
We not... Not just... ballers and rappers.
Drunk clappers are athletes that run faster. We not.
Not just ballers and rappers.
Trappers are actors, the brothers running NASA. We not.
Not just ballers and rappers.
We the masters of anything that you hand us. We not.
Not just ballers and rappers.
This is a new chapter, it's called the hereafter. No presidential pardon for the elements that charge us. We're being criminals because the television stars us. And cause you got fame don't mean you relevant to marches. And since you not a leader, then your negligence will harm us. And when we say a leader, then our reference is a martyr. Like nobody today can take a message from the father, imparted to our sons and give lessons to our daughters. Except LeBron, Lil Wayne, and President Obama. Nah, we got a lot of activists and scholars organizing the hood for the good and not the dollars. Holla, every unsung hero I wanna honor. From the Berg to Bahamas, consider this good karma. I'ma give you light cause the fact they wanna bury us. CNN don't know about being black in America. And Fox News is like non-stop fools. That's why I drop jewels, cause we're hip-hop fools. We not.
Not just ballers and rappers.
Drunk clappers are athletes that run faster. We not.
Not just ballers and rappers.
Trappers are actors, the brothers running NASA. We not.
Not just ballers and rappers.
We the masters of anything that you hand us. We not.
Not just ballers and rappers.
This is a new chapter, it's called the hereafter. We so much greater than how they portray us as. We're more champions than Kobe and the Lakers have. But they always make us have guns, mad faces, and disgraces. And show the world our shame like a naked man. I hate it, man. So I guess I gotta take a stand, cause I rep the X like that flag from Jamaica, man. And when I say Jamaica, you think Usain Bolt, or a dread that came by boat with Mary Jane to smoke. Like our brains are broken, we just came to joke. Like new millennium slaves with chains round our throat. But our own laziness is what I blame the most. We can't achieve if we just believe in change and hope. Find our lane and coast and remain the folks that just slang the dope and only aim the toast. Gang bang and boast, we need retrained and re-educated so we don't get the same results. So we not.
Not just ballers and rappers.
And welcome back to Not Another Sports Show, your progressive look at the world of sports. Craig James, a former Southern Methodist running back, former Patriots running back, an ESPN analyst, and a apparently recent insider to treason against the United States of America, has indicated that he may be interested in running for the U.S. Senate from the great state of Texas. He's been turning out some tired old right-wing canards like, quote, why does the government have to be involved in everything we do, end quote. He also likens the current social and political climate to that of 1765. Quote, I think America's today, if you placed us back in 1765, it would be the same scenario, James said. We've got the American Revolution taking place again. For those of you who don't know who Craig James is, he was a famous running back from Southern Methodist University during the early 80s, and has a sports writer who we've been able to have on this show, D. Will D.K. Wilson, had observed, quote, though James swears to this day that he never received cash while at SMU, and that the only reason he attended Southern Methodist was because his high school girlfriend was to attend the university. He was alleged to have had, thanks to the largesse of the Mustang boosters, lived in a rent-free apartment, as well as several other SMU football players, which in itself is a major NCAA violation. James, Eric Dickerson, who is now a Hall of Fame running back, and another host of SMU players, part of the class of 1982, were alleged to have been the first Mustangs football class who were beholden in many ways to the boosters. So while James might not have received cash payments during his days as a Mustang, he was a part of the reason Southern Methodist has not participated in a bowl game until 2009, because the NCAA dropped what was called the death penalty on the Southern Methodist program, which incredibly limited the amount of scholarships that they could give and pretty much just disabled their whole program. Right. To where they've called it like a nuclear bomb,
and
they've learned that they don't want to have to drop it again.
Wow. But there's some additional controversy surrounding James, right? And this, I think, just recently coming out. It has to do actually with James's son, Adam James, who was allegedly isolated by former Texas Tech coach Mike Leach for refusing to practice following a concussion.
And, you know, and on this show, 99% of the time, I think we're going to be supportive of the players rather than necessarily coaches and owners, especially college football players who are getting no compensation
absolutely
for what they're doing. But this case is
a little different, a little nuanced. Yeah, and I have to admit, you know, at first my knee jerk reflex was to feel a little bit of sympathy for Adam James here, but just listen to the whole story, folks, and then you be the judge. So Craig James apparently exercised his position of prominence to have Coach Leach dismissed following this incident of isolation of his son Adam. James, a sophomore, is known to past and present Tech players and all the coaching staff to have been a problem player. He has flaunted rules, he has exhibited a negative attitude toward direction given by coaches, and has openly complained to the coaching staff about his feeling that he should be higher in the team's wide receiver depth chart. James was reported to have returned to the field the day after being diagnosed in street clothes with his Tech cap turned backward and wearing sunglasses. Like, all of this is a violation of Leach's rules for his team, right?
Right.
But, I mean, there, you know...
It very much appears that he's a very spoiled, overprivileged
rat. He's an overprivileged little brat. Yeah, and I guess a series of emails and statements have come out from... former players that have worked with James, and even like assistant coaches and trainers, and it just does not paint a pretty picture here at all. So I've got a quote here from Graham Harrell, former player. He says, quote, "The coaches were always more than fair to Adam, I felt, because he came in the game during certain formations and situations last football season, but because of his work ethic and attitude, many of the players on last year's team had a hard time trusting him or relying on him because he was not always practicing, and we had seen his laziness during the off season. Adam was a kid that seemed like he had been given everything he wanted his whole life and acted like if things did not go exactly how he wanted, someone was treating him unfairly or someone needed to be blamed for his failures. He was a selfish player on and off the field that was counterproductive for our team and would be for any other team."
Wow.
No, yeah, it's harsh. And, I mean, it just goes on, right?
The strength and conditioning coach, Benny Wiley, had said, quote, "2 days prior to this incident in question, I disciplined Adam James along with several other receivers. His attitude was poor the entire time, even with constant pleas for improvement. By the end of the practice, a few other receivers accepted their lack of performance in the previous practice and worked harder. Adam was not one of these individuals. He was last on all of the exercises asked to do and talked and danced during the discipline. When told that this was unacceptable, he simply shrugged his shoulders. I continued to encourage him to no success."
Yeah, I mean, just sounds like a little brat. Let's see, what else do we got here? The assistant coach, Lincoln Riley. "Two practices before Adam James claimed he had a concussion, Coach Leach and I were forced to discipline him for poor effort from the previous practice and poor effort during the early drills of that day. This has been a common theme about Adam's work ethic and attitude during his entire career. Adam, along with two other receivers that were also unsatisfactory, was sent to run stadium steps with Benny Wiley. After the practice, Benny made it very clear to Coach Leach and I that Adam was a complete, quote, jerk while he was being punished." This was according to Lincoln Riley, assistant coach, who goes on to say, "I have no doubt that anger from this led to where we are today with this situation and is his way of trying to get back at us coaches."
Which definitely paints a very different story than the one that we are getting in the mainstream media of Leach being a overbearing, harsh coach. Because most of his players have had nothing but good things to say about him.
Yeah.
And most of them have been verbally pooping all over Adam James.
Yeah, no, I think
in this situation.
Yeah, this is, you know, Adam James going, you know, my daddy is a big shot ESPN announcer, and you know, he can get you fired if you don't do what I want.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, spoiled
and
brat.
Texas Tech's alums are also very upset, with many writing letters in support of Coach Leach to the university. They've started a petition, which has gotten a lot of signatures. And since the firing, the Lubbock-based Texas Tech Alumni Association has been flooded with letters, emails, and calls. Quote, "The overwhelming majority are very upset about it, very mad, and threatening to withdraw all support from Texas Tech," said Executive Vice President of the Texas Tech Alumni Association, Dr. Bill Dean. Dean says more than 100 alumni have already asked for their memberships not to be renewed, meaning that at least a $35 donation a year per person.
Yeah.
So very much in Texas, it's very widely accepted that James is in the wrong here, and they're vastly supporting Leach.
Right. I mean, and Leach has a reputation of being tough, right? And I mean, there's reports of some like somewhat unique disciplinary measures that he's taken with other players. Like there, I can't remember the name of the player, but a player who wasn't studying, I guess wasn't performing very well in classes or something like that, wasn't doing his homework, and Leach set up a desk on the 50-yard line
and made him do his homework.
Made him do his homework there, yeah, out in the middle of I guess some blowing snow flurries, right? I'm sure the guy learned a lesson, right?
Yeah, I think he probably learned his lesson that he should be doing homework.
And, exactly.
You know, it wasn't anything that was overly harsh, but I think Adam James is playing the C-word, concussions. And the big problem that we've got with concussions in sports, to try to make Leach look like a bad guy here, and just given this situation, I can't really side with the player here because he just seems like he's an egotistical little brat.
Yeah, and as serious as the concussion issue is, you know, like you said, having a little brat, make false claims about this stuff, it dilutes the seriousness of the concussion issue. You know, there's people who seriously do have concussions and seriously, you know, should not be practicing under those sorts of conditions or playing in those sorts of conditions.
And at best, even if he was seriously having a concussion, you know the team rules. You don't show up flouting the team rules to the meeting.
Yeah.
Unless you want to get punished. And so even if he was, you know, the basic simple respect for the job that you've got, the position that you've got, you should show that basic respect rather than just showing up and causing problems.
No, yeah, the guy's a mess.
and speaking of causing problems, the Baseball Hall of Fame vote took place, and former Cub Andre Dawson was the only player to reach the threshold and be voted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Another noted pitcher, Bert Blyleven, missed by 5 votes.
Wow.
From getting in. And that was his 13th year on the ballot. The votes come from sports writers all over America. And honestly, having watched this so many times, I can barely understand any of this. Take, for example, the human windsock, Jay Mariotti. For those of you who may have followed Chicago sports, Jay Mariotti is a scourge to Chicago sports. He was such a terrible writer that he was actually banned from the White Sox clubhouse. And full disclosure, I am a diehard White Sox fan. He also allegedly almost got into a fight with announcer Hawk Harrelson after Harrelson repeatedly on the air called him a Heine bird, which the definition is a bird which flies around in concentric circles until its head goes up its butt and it completely disappears. Mariotti frequently would change his opinion about different things in the sporting world depending on what was popular. In 2005, he started out writing columns about how the White Sox were not going to win the World Series, the White Sox were terrible, and after the White Sox won the World Series, he quickly started writing a series of columns praising the White Sox for having won, saying that he knew about it all along.
I love it. This guy should go into politics.
To call what he does journalism is really sliming the name of journalism. But this year, he turned in a blank Hall of Fame ballot, saying, quote, "I didn't vote for anybody in the Baseball Hall of Fame this year. You know why? To me, the first ballot is sacred." Well, you know, I'm just going to stop right there. You know what? That's a joke. There are plenty of players, first ballot Hall of Famers, that deserve to get in on the first ballot. It sounds like the guys that don't want to like have a unanimous vote for somebody that should get in on the first ballot, like when Cal Ripken Jr. and stuff was up for. People purposely didn't vote for him just to make sure it wasn't unanimous for some reason. Going back to Mariotti. I think Roberto Alomar is an eventual Hall of Famer. Not the first time. Edgar Martinez, designated hitter. Eventually, but not the first time. Same goes for maybe Fred McGriff. As far as Blyleven and Dawson, if they haven't gotten in for years and years, I cannot vote them in now, end quote. Yet a simple looking back at his past voting record belies that second part of his statement. Mariotti voted for Jim Rice last year on his 15th try. And you know who else he found deserving of the vote last year? Andre Dawson and Bert Blylevin.
Oh, for crying out loud.
This hypocritical guy saying they're not deserving to get in after he voted for them the season before.
One season over. Nope, they missed it.
Another example of this kind of idiocy comes from writer Bill Conlon. Quote, I voted for Tim Raines in his first year of eligibility. But when he failed to get 25% of the vote, he was moved to the back burner. Sorry, that's just the way it has to be. Maybe more eligible ball writers should have measured Rock's career's numbers in all phases against those of analog base dealer and first ballot inductee Lou Brock. Try it, you'll be amazed. Good news for Raines, however. Yesterday, in one of the most bizarre elections in a bizarre process, he collected 30% and is now back on my radar, close quote. So he voted for a player and then didn't vote for a player in subsequent years because the other sports writers didn't vote for him.
Why don't, just hand that ballot over to someone else. Let them vote for you.
This isn't about, like, being on the right side of history. That's for, like, you know, like, issues about, like, gay marriage, progressive taxes and education and stuff. No one cares if you were on the right side of the vote in the Hall of Fame for baseball. If you think a player is deserving of the Hall of Fame, vote for that player. If you do not think a player is deserving for the Hall of Fame, do not vote for that player. Instead of this, I'm going to vote for them this year, and then I'm not going to vote for them next year. And even Bert Blylevin in his public statements, when one year he received over 55% of the vote, and then the next year he went down to 43%, and even he was confounded. I don't get it. How do you vote for me one year and then not vote for me the next year? My numbers haven't changed. I haven't given up more home runs. My ERA hasn't gone up. I haven't pitched any more complete games. They're the same statistics. If you think a player is supposed to get in, vote for them.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and it's not... Yeah, I mean, this logic just makes no sense at all. You know, he wants to be with the cool people, I guess. I mean, apparently he just doesn't have an opinion of his own, right? Whatever.
And Major League Soccer. I know, Major League Soccer. I have a few friends that are huge Major League Soccer fans, and I don't get it.
Oh, but come on. Okay, we'll talk about it later.
They may be coming to a major labor impasse. A 5-year collective bargaining agreement expires at the end of the month, and owners are threatening to shut things down unless the terms of a new collective bargaining agreement stay about the same, which doesn't sit well with the players or FIF Pro, which represents players around the world. And no wonder. Players have contracts with the league rather than with their teams. The contracts almost always have multiple 1-year team options, and the contracts are rarely guaranteed. So they could get injured, and they don't get guaranteed money.
Wow.
Even after being terminated, the players' rights still belong to that team. Sounds like nouveau chattel slavery, that they can constantly be held in ad infinitum by some soccer franchise.
Yeah, that's crazy. What a mess.
That is a very, very big problem. And that concludes our very long News of the Week segment this week.
A lot of stuff going on this week.
So yeah. There's a whole lot of information going on, which kind of we'll go into a little bit in a few minutes about the NFL and some of the current labor issues that are being faced by the NFL, but we might not be able to cover it all. So we're going to take a brief break again. This is just like Democracy Now. We take 2 breaks. So we will talk to you in just a few minutes. Keep listening to Not Another Sports Show, your progressive view of the world of sports.
Somewhere between prayer and revolution, between Jesus and Huey P. Newton. That's where you find Johnny Five shooting water guns at the audience while you're scooting. Your gluteus max due to the fact that he's tooting on the horn, gonna warn you that I'm rooting for the other team in the culture war. So I stab the beast belly as the vulture snores. Yo, yo, let it blow with convulsive force till walls fall off their false supports, till Jericho's aircraft carriers alter course, and all brave young Americans are called ashore. Cause we've already lost the war they keep waging, splattering the streets and battles that keep raging, bloody in each page in the story that we're studying. Each day the same, just the names keep changing,
saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been all over the globe on our government funds, leaving man, woman, and child dead, bloody and numb.
Saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been overthrowing leaders with legitimate views, democratically elected, but we didn't approve.
How many times can the line divide? How many wars to uphold your pride? These fears uncontrolled just swirl the tide of blood in the streets while the people die. I'ma keep on trying, long as suffering is multiplying. And why not? These souls getting tossed and left out. I rob my bags broad enough to help lift your cross. As long as you help with mine, the process of healing will take some time. To see the pain in your face is the same as mine. It's not a game or a race, but the stakes is high. We maintain our mistakes for the sakes of sight. As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time. As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time. As long as it takes, I'll say it one more time.
Saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been all over the globe on our government funds, leaving man, woman, and child dead, bloody and numb.
Saying the same things over again, repeating the same slogans, we don't know where we've been.
We've been overthrowing leaders with legitimate views, democratically elected, but we didn't approve.
Same thing.
US is not us.
Same thing.
And us is not we.
Same thing.
And we are not satisfied.
Same thing.
We're tired of the same thing.
Same thing.
And we're ready to make.
Okay, and welcome back. This is Not Another Sports Show, your progressive view of the world of sports. And today we're going to spend a little bit of time, what's left in our program, to talk about some modern-day labor issues related to the National Football League, as well as their extensive labor history. And if you are interested in labor issues, on WEFT 90.1 FM, our friends over at the Illinois World Labor Hour broadcast from 11 a.m. until noon, talking about working class issues and other issues related to workers and
I guess government. Throughout the region and the country and the world. So listen to them from 11 to noon, take a little break for lunch, then catch us on WRFU, and that'll round out your Saturday late morning and afternoon.
Yes. Or catch us anytime you want to in the iTunes podcast.
Absolutely.
In the iTunes store by searching Not Another Sports Show. And you can listen to us anytime you choose.
That's right.
Or you can listen to classic episodes. And stealing from Car Talk, by classic, we mean old. Speaking of old, the National Football League was created in 1920, and when it was originally created, it was very haphazard. They gave the championship out to the team with the best win-loss record. However, there was no set schedule, so certain teams could schedule Powder Puff teams and just really terrible teams to play against to pad their record.
Of course.
And it wasn't until the 1930s when the first championship game was finally introduced. And the Players Association, which we're kind of concerned with, the NFL Players Association, was created in 1956 after most of these things got established, and it was very clear that this was going to be a very big enterprise with the start of some TV deals in the 1950s and the increasing popularity after World War II of professional football. At first, the Players Association had focused on things like minimum salaries, having the teams pay for their equipment rather than the individual player, continued pay to injured players who would no longer be able to play, and extra money for playing preseason games. Of course, the ownership routinely refused to bargain on these issues and refused and just outright ignored the players for the most part, until a Supreme Court case, Radovich versus NFL, ruled that the NFL was subject to antitrust lawsuits in 1956. And very quickly, the owners made lots of concessions to the players to avoid further antitrust litigation.
It's just amazing that players were responsible for purchasing their equipment before that. Jeez.
Well, like, even in baseball in the early years, Comiskey, kind of blanked the name there for a second, forced his team to pay for their own laundering of their uniforms.
Man, that's just low. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
In the middle of 1958, many of these concessions, like extra pay for preseason games, were still not happening. They were only put in place by subsequent threats of antitrust lawsuits, which included even pension benefits being started to be paid by the owners at the start of the 1959 season.
Wow.
Then there was some competition, which kind of caused a lot of big problems for the Players Association. Longtime football fans remember the American Football League, or the AFL, which started in 1960, which is now mostly the AFC after the teams got contracted in, when it merged with the NFL in 1968. And there was a very big labor split. The NFL Players Association represented 16 of the 26 teams in the NFL, and the AFL Players Association represented the other 10, and they didn't always agree on labor issues and labor policies to take. In 1968, the players had prepared to go on strike when certain demands were unmet. Instead, they were locked out for a week by management, and then staged a brief strike. That strike eventually led to the first ever collective bargaining agreement. The agreement called for far less than the players had hoped to achieve. Under the contract eventually agreed to, minimum salary remained at $9,000 for rookies, $10,000 for veterans. Exhibition game pay stayed at $50 a game. The commissioner remained as the sole arbiter of any disputes. Now, the reason the players had to accept these modest gains is that the AFLPA had accepted the terms without telling the NFLPA.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
And because they were split, it caused a very big problem that they couldn't have one united front when dealing with the owners. In 1970, the AFLPA and the NFLPA merger and become the first union for all football players inside the United States. In July of 1970, the players again went on strike, a very acrimonious relationship between them and owners. But the strike only lasted 2 days because owners were threatening to cancel the entire season and leave all of these players without pay for the entire year. Eventually, the Players Association signed a 4-year agreement that increased the minimum salary to $12,500 for rookies and $13,000 for veterans. Most of the other system were kept in place, but the pension was improved and dental benefits were added. Most significantly, the 1970 agreement gave the right players to meaningful representation on the retirement board and the right to have impartial arbitration of injury grievances. They also voted to file suit against the NFL to eliminate what was then known as the Roselle Rule, which effectively prevented players from moving from one team to another when their contracts expired. This lawsuit eventually became known as Mackey versus the NFL. In 1974, labor issues and labor and management were still very, very much at odds, and it was very clear that there was going to be another possible impasse. The owners were unmoved by the NFLPA's demands, especially eliminating the Roselle Rule, which drastically eliminated the idea of free agency. Believing that the owners could win in court, owners steadfastly and outrightly refused to participate in the collective bargaining process. On July 1st, the players went on strike, but by August 10th, the owners had still not agreed to a single demand. In frustration, the players called off the strike and took the battle to the courts. The ensuing standoffs led through the 1974, 1975, and 1976 seasons, with the NFL Players Association winning Mackey versus NFL, where the owners were found to be outright violating labor and antitrust laws. From 1977 to 1981, the collective bargaining agreement was in place, where teams would get compensated with draft picks if a free agent from their team was signed by another team. This meant that there was very little player movement because a first-round draft choice or more was too high a price to pay for signing another team's free agent. At least that was the excuse owners gave. However, players realized that the owners' practice of sharing TV and gate revenues pretty much equally meant that the clubs had no incentive to bid on free agents. Whatever their cost in terms of draft choices, most stadiums were full. So why would an owner bid millions of dollars for a free agent if his revenues couldn't go any higher as a result?
Yeah.
So there was really no interest for these owners to want to sign any of these possible free agent players, even if they didn't have to give up any draft choices. So when the next collective bargaining agreement came up in 1982, this is probably one of the more famous labor stoppages, as well as the 1987 strike. The players had adopted a proposal that called for players to be paid 55% of the club's league-wide revenues. These revenues would be divided among the players based on the service on the league, play time, and individual and team performance. The proposal was designed to pay new players based on performance, not how high they were drafted or how well they were expected to play. The owners rejected it, and a 57-day strike resulted. The 1982 collective bargaining agreement was eventually signed in December of 1982 after 3 weeks of continued negotiations. When it was signed, the owners paid $60 million in money now benefits, which offset much of the salaries players lost while on strike. The players also gained severance pay for the first time and increases in minimum salary, injury protection, and other monetary benefits. The biggest labor demands came in 1987. Damien, if you want to pick it up there.
Sure. In 1987, owners refused to negotiate the topic for unrestricted free agency. And so players therefore voted in the spring of 1987 to authorize a strike. Nevertheless, hoping one could be avoided through compromise. But instead of compromising, Jack Donlin, who was again the owner's spokesman, began planning for the use of replacement players in an event that a strike was called. 15% of the real players crossed the picket line during the 1987 scab season. It was a 24-day strike. Some fans ridiculed the replacement versions of their favorite teams as the San Francisco Phony Niners, the Los Angeles Shams, or the Chicago Spare Bears. The NFLPA sent the players back to work on Thursday, October 15th, 1987. The same day, however, the NFLPA filed an antitrust lawsuit against the NFL in federal court in Minnesota, challenging the owner's intent to continue the first refusal compensation system and other restrictions on players from the previous agreement. Plan B allowed teams to restrict 37 players from the free agency pool. In 1989, the judge told the NFLPA that if they are a union, they can't use the antitrust. So the teams decided to have a professional association instead of a union.
Yeah, they dissolved the union in 1989.
Decertified themselves, right?
Yeah.
It's a brilliant stroke of strategy. In September 11th, 1992, the jury found that the Plan B system violated the antitrust law because it was more restrictive than it had to be to achieve competitive balance. On damages, however, the jury ruled that only four of the eight plaintiffs awarding a total of $543,000 for Dave Richards, Lee Rousen, Frank Minifield, and Mark Collins. Most importantly, though, the legal issue had been won, and the players finally were able to strike down the Plan B system.
In August of 1993, approval for the negotiations between the players and the owners took place again. The owners agreed to outright free agency, but only if there was a salary cap. And players ultimately agreed to the salary cap if a certain percentage of costs were given to the players. The owners would have to agree that there would be no cap in the last year of a deal, 1999. In addition, $195 million in damages would have to be paid to settle the various antitrust court actions of the individual players. In January of 1993, with the negotiations settling and no more need for antitrust lawsuits, the NFLPA reconstituted itself into a union.
Once again.
And that is very quickly a long history of a radical union of the NFL Players Association. We most don't think of these players as workers, but they've had a very contentious discussion and interaction with the owners of the league, and it's only coming into a more modern issue with a 2011 collective bargaining agreement coming up to be discussed. So very briefly, we're going to take a break before we talk about another owner and our better-known owner segment. And just for those owners, we have a special song just for you guys.
You're listening to WRFU FM 104.5.
Welcome back just for the last concluding segment of Not Another Sports Show, your progressive view of the world of sports. And that was our special little shout-out to most of the owners out there. Our better-known owner segment is going to be very quick, and again, full disclosure, I am a Chicago White Sox fan, so this is more than fun for me to do. We're talking about Carl Pohlad, the former owner of the Minnesota Twins, who died just recently in 2009. I knew I had to pick Pohlad for this segment because he got his start in business during the Great Depression. You know what his job was, Damien?
Doing terribly evil things.
Foreclosing on farmhouses.
Yeah. what a jerk.
As an owner, he routinely cried poverty, yet he bought out huge financial banking chains. And for the last 20 years, the Twins' payroll had been near the bottom half of the major league teams. And in 2000 and 2001, they were last.
Wow.
Stars such as David Ortiz blossomed elsewhere because of the team would not pay to keep them. For more than a decade, Mr. Pohlad had tried to convince local politicians in Minnesota to approve a taxpayer-funded stadium to replace the Twins' ball field, the Metrodome, which was built in 1982. When no stadium was forthcoming, Pohlad threatened to sell the team to a highest bidder in 1997. In 2001, he again threw another temper tantrum when he offered to sell the Twins to his fellow Major League owners and contract the team and fold the franchise for a mere $150 million.
Jeez.
During the end of his life, a new stadium was approved and a projected opening of April 2010. I guess if, you know... He wasn't able to see it, but
his money-grubbing legacy lives on.
His money-grubbing legacy does live on. And you have been listening to Not Another Sports Show here. We'll be back next week with another set of topics to talk to you about the progressive world of sports. And we are out.
fallen leaves drift by my window.